You're listening to Making Contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Joining me now is Vina Dubal. She's a staff attorney at the National Security and Civil Rights Program at the Asian Law Caucus based in San Francisco. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
So over the past decade, San Francisco, like many American cities, has had an increase in police targeting and harassment of Middle Eastern-looking or Muslim-looking people. But here the community, especially recently, has been getting really organized. Can you talk about what the problem has been and also the steps that have been taken to remedy the situation?
Sure. You certainly hit the nail on the head. This has been going on over the past 10 years and actually well before that. What catalyzed the organization that we see in the community in San Francisco was actually SFPD Chief Gascon's comments early last year at a earthquake bond brunch, where he said that the city didn't just have to fear earthquakes, but also members of the city's Middle Eastern communities blowing up buildings. This was captured by the San Francisco Chronicle and subsequently went viral, especially in the South Asian Arab and Muslim community that felt really targeted by this statement. And although Chief Gascon eventually apologized at a very public Jummah one Friday, the community still felt sort of troubled by this. They had experienced to a degree profiling and harassment for many, many, many years. But the fact that the highest police officer, the SFPD chief of police, made this statement was for them representative of a more problematic culture that perhaps is pervasive among all of SFPD. And so they didn't just want an apology. They wanted more transparency and accountability around issues of racial religious profiling. So we went, we took the issues that the community was giving to us, was sending to us via complaints, via individual stories, and we started a coalition. And when I say we, I mean the Asian Law Caucus, the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, the Council on American Islamic Relations, and a number of other organizations and individuals. We started weekly meetings to discuss what the community wanted to do about the fact that the chief had made these statements and that the statements were reflective of their larger experiences with profiling. What the community wanted to do was to be heard. And so we decided to hold a formal hearing in City Hall via the Human Rights Commission and have the experiences of the community be not just heard by the Human Rights Commissioners, but become official city testimony that the city actually had to respond to.
And so the feeling is that Chief Gascon's comments, I'm getting the impression, gave you an opening to make the city really confront an issue that had been there beforehand?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's funny in that way because they were really tragic, awful comments that hurt people, that really made people feel like this wasn't their city when really it is. But it did give us, it was a catalyzing moment for the community that, you know, enough was enough. It was enough that they'd experienced these things, but that the chief of police had put it, had actually named what they were experiencing was so moving that it caused people to band together.
And what type of things were they experiencing?
A lot of the folks that I've spoken to in the community have been stopped by SFPD officers in the Tenderloin and asked about their asked for their ID or asked for their some people have been asked about their religious identity. People throughout the Bay Area have been harassed by local police officers who are members of the Joint Terrorism Task Force and asked about their religious identity, asked how many times a day they pray, asked about their affiliations and their associations. And again, this is not, they're not being asked these questions by the FBI. They're being asked these questions by local police officers who are assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force. In addition to experiences that they've had at the hands of local police officers that are troubling, many people have trouble flying in and out of San Francisco. And, you know, the no-fly list has become a just a behemoth of the problem for the Muslim community. There's no rule of law, it seems, that really regulates what's going on with the no-fly list. But in addition to that, just everyday Americans who are flying in and out of the country or traveling internationally have had a real problem at SFO when they come back into the country, being put into secondary inspection ostensibly because of where they travel to, because of their national origin, even when they're U.S. citizens, and because of their religious identity or political affiliations, are asked numerous questions about legitimate questions about where they traveled, but questions about who they visited when they traveled, what they did when they traveled, what mosques they frequent here in America, how many times a day they pray. A lot of, you know, intelligence gathering at the border that has really intimidated people. And then, of course, people who have been questioned throughout the Bay Area and Northern California by the FBI about these same questions. And again, the problem with all of this type of questioning, profiling, and harassment is not necessarily just that it's happening, but that it's happening to people with no criminal predicate. These are people with, for the most part, no nexus to criminal activity, not people that the authorities have any reason to suspect. But people who have affiliation with Islam, people who are Muslim, people who are Arab, people who have political associations that the government finds threatening, not necessarily people who have committed any acts of wrongdoing.
Yeah, and at least one way to describe what you've been talking about, I've heard, is preemptive prosecution. And that's where people are arrested supposedly to prevent them from committing a crime. And it's a term that's being used more widely to describe some of the cases around the country. Usually the government busts what they call a cell, or perhaps it's a lone wolf, a single person, and the evidence turns out to be questionable, or often the evidence turns out to be secret, so we can never really know the evidence. Have these types of cases decreased as we get further from 9/11? And what about since the Obama administration took office? Has he taken a different tack than President Bush?
Yeah, so I think that part of what I'm describing is are the first steps to preemptive prosecutions, where people who haven't really done anything wrong are being investigated. But when it comes to preemptive prosecutions, I think since September 11th, we've seen a huge, you know, rise in these types of cases. Interestingly, a lot of people are being charged under Criminal Code 1001, which was signed into law under President Bill Clinton in the 90s, and actually makes it a federal crime for someone to affirmatively lie to a federal agent on something that is relevant to an investigation. So, for example, if I'm a material witness to a crime, and the FBI comes to interview me, and they ask me when I traveled to Pakistan, and I said, you know, I think I traveled back in September 2010, and really I had gone in October of 2010, but that my travel dates were material to their investigation, I just lied to an FBI agent, which can get me many, many years in jail. So a lot of the people who are being preemptively prosecuted are being prosecuted under this type of law. What we saw in in Portland, what we saw here in Lodi are people being charged with both lying to federal agents and with intending to commit acts of terrorism where the intent is highly suspect, especially when it's the FBI that's actually provided all of the weapons, provided the idea, the genesis of the potential act of terrorism, etc. But it's very, very troubling, especially when you look at the types of people who are being targeted by preemptive prosecution. They're certainly not middle-class Americans. These are often poverty-stricken individuals who already live on the outskirts of society financially, socially, emotionally. Probably people were troubled and, you know, in many different ways who are vulnerable to this type of prosecution. I think it was Eric Holder who at a dinner sponsored by a prominent Muslim civil rights organization recently said that, you know, this type of preemptive prosecution isn't new. He was defending it. He said that it's been a key to criminal investigations over a long period of time. And, you know, he accurately stated that this is long been what the government has been doing in its war on drugs. And, you know, I thought that was a telling connection that he made the war on drugs and the war on terrorism in a way, the way in which both of these acts of preemptive prosecution are actually in some ways a form of social control over people who are viewed as threats to the state, whether that's a black man, whether that's a brown man. You know, situations are certainly different in those respects, but they're being used in these particular contexts.
Interesting. You mentioned the war on drugs and that analogy. Increasingly these days, we're seeing a lot of members of law enforcement, often retired, admitting that the war on drugs is a failure. Don't know if we're there yet on the topic we're talking about, but I'm wondering, in your dealings with the local police department, do you think that the authorities often believe in the prosecutions they're doing? Do they believe these people are a threat to public safety, or does this come down from their chief or the FBI or Department of Justice or White House? I mean, it's no secret that a lot of the people, all the way up to the people in Guantanamo Bay, are actually innocent. So do you think most of the people who are executing these crime-fighting strategies believe they're necessary, or is it political, or is it racial, or is it media-fueled? Where is the root of this?
I think that certainly it's all of those things. I think that the everyday FBI agents on the ground have a directive, and that directive comes from the very top to make sure there are no acts of terrorism that happen on U.S. soil ever, ever again. And because they have this directive and they have all these resources and they have guidelines that basically allow them to do anything, they use you know, whatever influences they have from media, from American media, from American foreign policy, from stereotypes that they see elsewhere, to do everything they can to make sure that terrorism doesn't happen. And I think that there are some misguided ideas about who commits acts of terrorism, what acts of terrorism are, why acts of terrorism are committed, et cetera, that cause many of these agents to, you know, maybe act beyond the scope of what we think would be appropriate law enforcement activity. One of the things that you asked me earlier was whether I saw things changing under President Obama. And what I think is really unfortunate, since we all had, you know, a lot of hope going into this Democratic administration, is that on national security policies, and indeed, I think generally on U.S. foreign policy, we have seen very little shift under Obama. In fact, you know, it's my opinion that things are worse than they were under President Bush, in part because Americans, you know, maybe some of your listeners even, think that, of course, things are going to get better. Now we have a constitutional law professor, an African-American man who himself has experienced racism in his life. We have this type of man who is our executive. Of course, these types of policies are changing. But when it comes down to it, what I think Americans don't know is that policies have not changed. So, for example, in 2008, right before Bush left office, the FBI, the DOJ passed a new set of guidelines. They're term DIOGs, Department Investigative Operational Guidelines, I think is what that stands for. And these guidelines are the only sort of, or they're the largest set of guidelines, the most prominent set of guidelines that FBI agents have to follow to regulate their own behavior. So prior to what's commonly referred to as COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program that Congress investigated in the 70s, which had been going on for many years, which had targeted, it was the FBI's program, which had targeted people like, you know, Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders. prior to COINTELPRO and the investigations that Congress had of COINTELPRO, there were no guidelines that the FBI followed, none at all. Very little congressional oversight. So the Attorney General at the time, Attorney General Levi, kind of in a compromise, instead of giving Congress statutory oversight over the FBI, created these internal guidelines that the Attorney General writes. So in 2008, they passed new guidelines. This was after Ashcroft. These are the Mukasey guidelines passed under Attorney General Mukasey. And what the guidelines do that no guidelines since COINTELPRO have ever done is create a new category of an investigation that's called an assessment. And under an assessment, an individual agent does not have to have any criminal suspicion of an individual before opening up an assessment. They have to have a purpose, but that purpose does not actually have to be related to an actual criminal suspicion of someone. So, for example, this is my own interpretation of the guidelines based on my experiences with them and with my clients. An FBI agent hears from someone in the community that there is a Muslim leader who is friends with a lot of people, who knows a lot of people, and has committed no act of wrongdoing, but he's like, okay, I'm going to go talk to this person. And he can do so. He can go talk to this person who he has no reason to suspect of any wrongdoing to perform a quote-unquote assessment. So 100% of my clients, as far as I can tell, have been approached under this category called an assessment. You know, my clients are small business owners, they are students, they are, everyday ordinary Americans who are just trying to make ends meet from day to day. All of them are practicing Muslims. Some of them are white of European descent. Some of them are Yemeni descent. Some of them are Pakistani descent, but they're all practicing Muslims. And as far as I can tell, that is the only reason that they have been approached by the FBI. And, the FBI repeatedly has stated, we don't racially and religiously profile. We don't racially and religiously profile. But it's very, under the assessment, it's very easy to say that if someone is Muslim, then you have reason enough, you have purpose enough to go talk to them. And this has caused a real troubling sort of snowball effect in the community. People who otherwise might have, wanted to talk to the FBI, who, if they had information about any kind of terrorist activity, might have wanted to go to talk to the FBI, are now scared to do so because of the kind of robust interviews you see happening in the community. Everyone is being interviewed. And so what we keep trying to say to the DOJ and to the FBI is, look, you're shooting yourself in the foot. You think that you're trying to stop terrorism by talking to everyone you can possibly talk to and gain information on everyone that you could possibly gain information on. But what you're doing is you're scaring a community whose trust you really need. And unfortunately, we don't think that they're hearing us say that.
And then I guess with the Joint Terrorism Task Forces, where the federal agents team up with and work together with the local departments, that mistrust can extend to the local police.
Absolutely. That's an excellent, excellent point. So one of the reasons that the FBI says that their Joint Terrorism Task Forces are so important is they say that no one knows a city like just a regular police officer who knows his beat really, really well. And so they say, it's very important to have these JTTFs because they're key to fighting terrorism. Unfortunately, these Joint Terrorism Task Force consists of literally 1 to 2 to 3 police officers who are assigned to a JTTF. So what's happening with these JTTFs is that you have individual officers, individual local law enforcement officers that are assigned to Joint Terrorism Task Force. They are essentially deputized to be FBI agents, but their salaries are paid by cities, by the local municipalities. So say, let's talk about Oakland, for example. In Oakland, you have, as far as I can tell, we only have one police officer that's assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force. Interestingly, I don't know that for sure because the Oakland Police Department will not tell us how many officers are assigned to the Joint Terrorism Task Force. As far as I can tell, based on my own client experiences, there's only one officer. And that officer, you know, despite the fact that Oakland is right now not responding to nonviolent crime, that they have incredible budget cuts, that they're basically facing an internal crisis, they have one of their own, one of their police officers assigned to the JTTF. And this JTTF officer, this OPD officer, is rather than responding to crime at all, is actually just going around talking to Muslims, creating a sense of fear in the community and making local Muslim communities trust local law enforcement even less than perhaps they did before. When I started to see this as a pattern, when our organization and the Council on American Islamic Relations started to get a lot of clients who were being approached by a JTTF officer, an Oakland police officer who was paid by Oakland, the city of Oakland, and Oakland taxpayers, when we started to hear more about this one particular JTTF officer and the kind of troubling questions that he was asking people about their religious identity, he was asking people these questions at their place of worship, at their place of work, etc., we decided we wanted to find out what rules and regulations he was following. Was he following Oakland rules and regulations? Was he following California law? Or was he following the FBI rules and regulations? And so we approached the city of Oakland. We filed a California Public Records Act request to see if we could find a memorandum of understanding between the FBI and the Oakland Police Department. And interestingly, the city attorney's office told us that the police department didn't have the memorandum of understanding and that the FBI would not provide it to them. So we said, okay, you have an agreement that you have signed with the FBI. You have all of these resources being funneled into this agreement, but you don't know what the agreement actually says. And so we said, okay, what is local, what is city law around these types of activities, around First Amendment protected activities, and what is state law? The California Constitution requires there to be some kind of nexus between criminal activity and a criminal investigation of that activity. Oakland City law also, because of a history, a century-long history of abuses where people, particularly political activists, have been profiled and investigated wrongfully by the OPD, where people have undergone a lot of unnecessary police attention as a result of their political activity, also has a protective order. I think it's called M17 within the Oakland Police Department that says that, you know, you cannot investigate someone unless they have committed some wrongdoing or you have suspicion that they have committed some wrongdoing. Well, it's my understanding that this Oakland police officer who's been deputized to the JTTF is not following California law and he's not following Oakland law. And this is something that we want Oakland taxpayers to know. Is this the kind of culture that you want to inculcate in your city? Is this okay with you that if you have someone, you know, break into your car overnight and call the police, they are not going to come because that's a nonviolent crime? But meanwhile, there is an officer out on the streets just talking to people about their religious activities, asking questions about about issues that are protected by the First Amendment. It's extremely troubling to us, and we're continuing to do advocacy around this at City Hall in Oakland to make sure that the mayor knows about this, to make sure that the city council knows about this, to make sure that, you know, the OPD knows about this, and we'd like to see things change. We'd like it so that our local resources are not being funneled into these federal projects that really violate people's civil rights.
I want to ask if there's an analogy to what happened during World War II. Right now, as the years go by, there are fewer and fewer people alive who remember the internment of the Japanese during that war, especially for Americans who don't live on the West Coast. They might not even know that the U.S. government rounded up people based solely on their race and country of origin and put them in camps. Do you think there's a danger of us collectively forgetting what happened then? And do you think there are some valid analogies to what's happening to South Asians and Muslims these days?
Absolutely. So as you probably know, the Asian Law Caucus, where I work, we house the Korematsu Institute. So Fred Korematsu was a Japanese-American who resisted internment and was criminally charged and jailed. His case went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and unfortunately, in a case that many people, many constitutional law professors think was one of the worst cases ever decided, the Supreme Court said that Japanese internment was valid, that it was not based, that they were not basing the rounding up of Americans of Japanese descent on their race or on their national origin or on their ancestry, but rather that they were doing this because we were at war with Japan. So obviously, since this has happened over the last 50, 60, 70 years, we've had time to think about this and think about why this was a wrongly decided case, etc. So Fred Korematsu's daughter is on the board of our organization. And after September 11th, Fred Korematsu made the connections himself, what he experienced being interned during World War II and what South Asian Arabs and Muslims have been experiencing since 9/11 and, you know, frankly, before 9/11. And he did a lot of outreach in the South Asian Arab and Muslim community. The Japanese American community more generally actually reached out to South Asian Arab and Muslim community saying, this is what, you know, we know what you're experiencing. We know the potential that there exists for your civil rights to be violated, and we want you to know that we support you and we stand in solidarity with you. That kind of support has been wonderful, and certainly members of our community have learned many lessons. And I say our community as a South Asian, I mean the South Asian Arab and Muslim community have learned many lessons from how the Japanese Americans responded to internment, and you know, many of us have gone to law school. Many of us, as a result of what we saw happen after September 11th, have become very politically active, civically engaged, and have tried to organize our communities. I've heard this comparison made between Japanese internment and the post 9/11 situation of South Asian Arab and Muslim civil rights abuses, often made in the sense that we've called what's happened to these communities, a type of virtual internment where people are afraid to think anything that might get them in trouble. They are afraid to say anything that might get them in trouble. They are constantly afraid of law enforcement. There is a burgeoning literature around this, not just an academic literature, but people have written many, many nonfiction books about the experience of young men and women after September 11th, being detained, disappearing, being sent to Guantanamo Bay, being questioned by the FBI, being preemptively prosecuted, etc. And certainly it's affected the psyche of a new generation in a way that, you know, I might even have trouble describing, has really inculcated a feeling of not belonging in this country, a feeling that especially for people who are second, third, fourth, fifth generation, people who, you know, call America home, who don't feel at home abroad and don't feel at home here either, a real sense of an identity, a split identity or a lack of identity or a lack of a place that really holds your identity. And, you know, if you asked me a year ago whether I thought there was any sort of risk of South Asian Arabs and Muslims being interned or being subject to anything as extreme as what happened to the Japanese Americans after World War II, I'd say no. I would have said, you know, America certainly learned its lesson, and I don't think that that's a risk. But, you know, with Representative King's hearings that we're seeing right now, with I don't know if your readers have seen, there's a video of an Orange County, a protest in Yorba Linda, what was termed a pro-American protest of a charity fundraiser, a Muslim charity fundraiser. It's an organization that was raising money for domestic violence victims and for homeless shelters, was protested by elected representatives. There were three elected representatives who spoke at this rally, one of whom effectively made a death threat to the people who had visited the charity or attended the charity fundraiser, saying that her son was a Marine and she knew plenty of Marines who wanted to help those, pointing to the charity fundraiser, those terrorists make it to paradise. Two other elected representatives spoke. People were screaming, go home, saying really terrible, awful things about the Prophet Muhammad, bad things about Islam. I just had never seen anything so, I had not seen so much vitriol. You know, I grew up in the South. I'm a woman of color. You know, I certainly, have seen the effects of white supremacy. We lived very close to KKK headquarters. I know the history of racism in this country, but I had never, and this is the work that I do, I have never seen, I would never have expected to see the kind of hate that I saw there, and that it was sanctioned by elected representatives really instilled a sense of a fear in me. And, you know, I wish I could say something different, but I honestly don't know where we're headed in this country in terms of how we treat particular people who we racialize to be terrorists. And I'm concerned certainly for myself and my family, but also for my children and for the entire community. And I'm really, really pleased that that media outlets and folks like journalists like yourself are willing to unearth some of what we're seeing going on. And I hope that your listeners take what they hear to heart and know that this isn't just, someone's civil right that's being violated, but these are lives that are being threatened, that this is the very fabric of our nation that's being threatened. It's the quality of life for everyone in this country that's being threatened by this culture of hate.
And what do you say to some folks who may be listening, who hear what you're saying, they want to treat people right, but they read the paper and they say, even if it's just half of what I'm reading, there are people out here from Middle Eastern descent who are committing terrorist acts. They see what's happening in London or India, and they feel like if it's better, if it can keep us all safe, we need to do this. And they believe there really is some truth, even if most people of this background are good people, the others aren't, and we need to do something about it. How do you respond to their feelings?
Well, it's certainly not making us any safer is my, I hate to actually speak to that culture of fear that fear breeds irrationality, and I'm afraid that there's a huge irrational response that is happening because of all of the fear that that people feel because of irresponsible media coverage, because of what elected representatives say, because of statements by our highest law enforcement agents, et cetera. But frankly, this response is not making us any safer, in part because it's creating fear, as I said earlier, fear in the very community that we want to have good relationships with, that we want to be able to come out and talk, feel safe talking about potential acts of terrorism, potential acts of criminal activity, and the kinds of civil rights violations that we are seeing are actually closing the door to that community, closing the door of trust between law enforcement and that members of that community. It's also not making us safe because it's feeding this sentiment that enables violence, which is that America is wronging our people and we need retribution. So the more and more and more innocent people whose rights are violated, whose lives are destroyed, the more kind of violent nonsense that the state perpetrates, the more ammunition people who want to discredit the United States have to do so. And that certainly isn't making, your listeners safer either. And I think that one of the things that people repeatedly say makes this country what it is the freedoms, the freedom of association, freedom of press, the fact that I can sit here and talk to you about this and not go home in fear that I'm going to be thrown in jail because I'm critiquing U.S. domestic policy. Those are, if certain communities hold these freedoms and certain communities don't hold these freedoms, then the very fabric that the very fabric of this country that we hold as we value and hold as being so great, is destroyed. And what's left? You know, what's left? A sense of safety that you're never really going to feel.
So whose perception is it most important to change in terms of righting some of these wrongs and kind of changing the directory of law enforcement strategies? Is it the authorities themselves or the general public, the media, and how can that be done?
I think it's absolutely everyone's responsibility. No one individual or no one entity. I hope that people feel civically responsible for those around them and for maintaining the liberty and freedoms and values that we all, you know, value and share. You know, someone recently, people often ask me, you know, what can I do? And, you know, I'm an attorney, and I represent individuals. And so sometimes I'm at a loss to give them answers. But recently someone came up to me and she said, you know, my mom lives in Florida and she goes to this church and people say God awful things about Muslims at this church. And she stands up and she says what she thinks. And she says to people that it's not okay to talk like that. It's not okay to, it's not Christian to talk about other human beings in this way and to, you know, racialize a whole community and to other a whole community and to feel this degree of unbridled hate for a whole other people. And I was so touched by that because it's hard. It's real. I mean, it's even for me sometimes, sit amongst a group of conservative people and I don't want to be that angry brown woman who's always, you know, putting people in their place. But it's so important if you hear someone say something, whether it's against the queer community, whether it's against a Jew, whether it's against a Muslim, whether it's against, you know, whomever, if you hear people say things that are violent and are problematic and you stay silent, then you are enabling that culture. And when nothing is said and people think it's okay to talk like that, that's when that kind of culture of hate becomes the hegemonic culture. And it's when people feel like, you know, I can say whatever I want to say, and I know that other people share my sentiment because no one's saying anything. And I think that when individuals push back, even just on a daily basis in their social circles, in their religious circles, that actually has much bigger impact than they would imagine.
Vina Dubal is staff attorney at the National Security and Civil Rights Program at the Asian Law Caucus in San Francisco. We'll link to their website at our site, radioproject.org. Vina, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for listening.